Hello and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the Agthentic Group. I'm Kirsten Diprose, here with a bonus episode. So, did Silicon Valley kill AgTech? Or at least set it back a decade? Ah yes, Silicon Valley, California. It's the tech sector's equivalent to Hollywood, where entrepreneurs see their dreams go boom or bust. It's seen as the birthplace of modern technology, quite literally taking its name from the region's sand, which contained the silicon used to manufacture the first computer chips. Now, Silicon Valley is synonymous with technology, rapid innovation, startups, and venture capital. It's the home of big tech companies like eBay, PayPal, Facebook, Intel, Alphabet, and of course, Apple. People now even talk about the Silicon Valley innovation model as a template for startup success. Yet when it's been applied to ag tech, well, we've seen mixed results.
So you may think that if I can just get the farmer to adopt my tool, then it's game over, I'm gonna go disrupt the system. But you find that there's like multiple layers of that onion to peel back before you can actually make change to that system. And I think that's one of the big ahas that a lot of folks have had.
So we're peeling that onion. That was Rob Trice, the founder of Better Food Ventures, a food and ag VC, and founder of The Mixing Bowl, which is connecting food, ag, and tech innovators in Silicon Valley and beyond. You'll also hear from Sarah Nollet, who you probably already know, as well as Matthew Pryor. They're both co-founders of Tenacious Ventures, an agri-food tech VC, and partners at the Agthentic Group. Both have strong ties to Silicon Valley and recently published an article with this very premise: how Silicon Valley set ag tech back a decade. It struck a chord, it was a little tongue-in-cheek, but it really started a conversation. So we thought we'd dig in further. But first, let's meet Rob.
Sure, so my name is Rob Trice, and I spent about just under 15 years in the mobile internet telecom venture capital space. I came here at the tail end of the dot-com bubble. I saw the burst. I was here for 9/11. I was here for 2008. When I started working on the mobile internet, we were on 2G networks. It was that time when people wondered, why would I ever want a map or email on my phone? And it was really exciting to see things like this new technology called Wi-Fi really come to be in Silicon Valley. But getting on with things around 2012, 13 or so, I just started to get tired. People were talking about 5G. And in my mind, I didn't have 5G in me. I've been going to the same conferences, talking about the same topics for a number of years. And at the same time, my wife started running this regenerative cattle ranch behind us, 45 minutes west of Silicon Valley, out on the Pacific coast. And so I literally was walking around this cattle ranch trying to figure out what I was going to do when I grew up. And I was looking at the fact that you'd seen Uber disrupt transportation, Airbnb disrupt lodging, and then saw a cowboy pulling an SD card out of a weather station, looking at these guys struggling to use Square at the farmer's market, and realized that 5 to 10% of the world's economy is ag food, and that Silicon Valley's innovation ecosystem at that point had not yet grabbed on to food tech and ag tech. And so I started two organizations, The Mixing Bowl and Better Food Ventures. The Mixing Bowl is a forum to connect IT food and ag innovators for thought and action leadership. And Better Food Ventures makes investments across the supply chain of food and ag in information technology companies looking to make a positive impact.
Great. Matt, is there some overlap in terms of your timelines and when you were in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, probably. I was co-founder of a software business in Melbourne in the late 80s, early 90s. And my first exposure to Silicon Valley was a subscription newsletter business. And I literally mean a mailed out newsletter. It was called Software Success. And it just was, we would get it once a month. And it was this amazing kind of missive about all this mythical stuff that would happen in this place called Silicon Valley. So eventually we decided that we needed to be there and kind of moved what we called the HQ of our software business, which was myself and one of my co-founders, to San Francisco. And it was interesting because kind of that was mid-90s. And at that time, San Francisco was sort of really on the cusp of Silicon Valley. It wasn't quite considered part of Silicon Valley then, but we set up in South of Market and were there for about 7 years as Silicon Valley just expanded kind of north and the city became this incredibly vibrant tech hub. It was an awesome time to be there. We went kind of right through the the absolute highs and the quite the serious lows of the original dot-com era, I think is what we're calling it now. But it, yeah, it was such a stark contrast to how I had experienced kind of software, and like there was no VC in Australia really at that time. So, you know, moving back in the kind of mid-aughts, it was interesting to sort of start to see that appearing in Australia, but I suppose considerably behind. I just through circumstance kind of got invited into a project that actually was trying to model pasture growth to estimate stocking rates for cattle properties in the north of Australia. And it just, I just had this light bulb moment. It's like, wow, all this stuff of software and this amazing, meaningful purpose of making sure that stocking rates were kind of set at sustainably low but economically meaningful rates. And the, kind of that was my journey from tech into ag tech.
And Sarah, what about you? You might have a different point of view being Silicon Valley born and bred.
Yeah, I guess I didn't see it as such a fairy tale land until I left. So I was born in Silicon Valley and well, I was born in San Diego, but I grew up in Silicon Valley, and both my parents worked in the semiconductor industry. And I definitely didn't realize at the time how unique that was, but you know, we'd have a Girl Scout fundraiser or something. And my mom would take me to her company and I'd get to put on the bunny suit and go in and see the chip fabrication equipment. And like, that was just the world I grew up in, and had no idea that it was revolutionizing, you know, the rest of the planet, because I was, you know, 10. So it was a pretty different perspective on that. But I guess it kind of sticks with you. I mean, I remember going to lots of business meetings with my dad, who also worked in the industry, and you just go to a Starbucks or, you know, Pete's Coffee or whatever around here, and you kind of look around and everyone's like pitching someone else and trying to get a deal up and doing business and hatching an idea, and there's notebooks and napkins and scraps. And so that energy was just what I grew up in, and I didn't really realize how special it was until I left and kind of looking back on it and seeing how much that entrepreneurial spirit and that kind of tech vibe is so alive here and really unique to other places in the world.
I guess now I want to move on to where agriculture fits in all of this and where it has tried and failed in the past to digitize or kind of change in Silicon Valley. Rob, what's your experience of it?
Well, I think I didn't know much about food or agriculture. And I actually started talking to some people who very quickly mentored me, if you will, to tell me that, you know, as opposed to like the social media investing that I had been doing, that tweeting and eating or food and agriculture is very different than social media, right? And for a variety of reasons, you know, all the reasons that we'll probably get into, but you know, that the innovation cycle is slower. You get something wrong with a social media app, you just do a software upgrade. You get something wrong in food, you can kill people, right? So like, there's a lot of, the stakes are higher. So I appreciated that I didn't know what I didn't know. I started to learn that. And I think it was healthy for me to step in the early stages of the space, to recognize that you couldn't just cut and paste the enterprise software model to agriculture. And then obviously, particularly agriculture and food to a lesser degree.
Rob, I'm curious, when you were first looking at this space, and one of the things I really respect and admire that you guys have done is a lot of convening, like bring in the venture cap, you know, the corporate venture capital from the tech world to talk to some farmers and some soil scientists. And you guys have been doing that all along. But when you first started doing it, like how awkward were those rooms to be in? Because those were people that weren't interacting, I imagine, like they are today.
So we did this event called Food IT, arguably the very first agri-food tech event in Silicon Valley. And I remember the first time that we did this, I don't know if you know Chris Patterson, who's at BASF, a big hulking 6'5" guy, Canadian farmer. That sounds like the beginning of a bad joke. And he walks up to me and he says, "I got something to say to you about this event." And I'm like, oh no, here it comes. He knows I'm a fake and a fraud. And he says, I go to all these ag tech events, and this is the best event that I've been to in 5 years. He goes, and the reason is I'm talking to chefs. I'm talking to people about food waste. He goes, when we go to ag tech conferences, we just talk to other farmers and so forth. Now I have the opportunity to actually see across the value chain. So I was relieved by that. And you know, one of the things that I found recently from that very first event was, you know, something that we called the stepping stones to solving food and ag challenges, which is we laid out kind of a purpose for the mixing bowl of seeing the issues, seeking solutions, solving issues, and then scaling solutions. And if you look at that, and I've written about this, my frustration is that currently we're still spending too much time seeing the issues and seeking solutions. We're not solving the issues that we need to in a timely or scaled fashion.
That's a really interesting insight. I want to kind of get an idea of what the VC playbook was like back in Silicon Valley when ag tech first came onto the scene. And I know that Matt and Sarah, you've both written about this in your article, how Silicon Valley set ag tech back a decade. Could you give us an idea of how it worked back then? And maybe it still works like this now.
I mean, I think the lived experience in San Francisco through that time, you know, showed the good and the bad. I mean, my indelible memory, like most people who've been to San Francisco know, it's very hilly. And my indelible memory is of a web van guy schlepping groceries up the 35 steps to the front door of our house. Like, web van was the first kind of deliver food to your home kind of effort. It was typical Silicon Valley boots and all. Like, they had their own fleet, they had their own everything. They built this massive distribution center in Oakland. I mean, it was like, I don't even know how many hundreds of millions of dollars they set in a pile and burn. But I think there was the experience of just like throw enough money at it and eventually you'll get the formula right. And when you zoom out to 30,000 feet, that does work. And now today we can see how the, you know, whatever started from WebVan and has become what it's become today worked. But I think, back to Rob's point about it's different in food and ag because, well, in ag, you're dealing with people's livelihoods, right? And so this idea of, oh, we'll just kind of try this thing and it may not work out for you, but it'll work out fine for the people 10 years after you. Like, for the most part, farmers can't and won't just take those kind of risks of maybe this will work out for me, maybe it won't. And I think that was kind of really where that point of difference really started to show up for us. Really, you know, like, I can put a whole bunch of stuff on Facebook and then maybe I delete it and, like, you know, it's not going to fundamentally change my bank balance. But the decisions that farmers make on every day, a basis, do, you know, fundamentally change their bank balance. And so they can't be cavalier about, you know, what little Silicon Valley experiment they want to be part of today or tomorrow.
Sarah, what are your insights on this?
Oh, well, it actually goes to something Rob and I were talking about earlier, where in some ways, like, ag has been optimized to remove risk and venture capital was built to embrace risk. And so there's this like fundamental disconnect in the two worlds. And that's where some of this clash has come because, yeah, we're like, oh, farmers, you know, they iterate every season. Like, a season's a long time. And the number of software iterations you'd get over that 12-month period is much higher than one. And then the next season comes around and it's different because you've got different rainfall and the soil has changed and the markets are different. And so, yes, there are many similarities between farmers as entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs in terms of mindset and owning businesses and experimentation, but the systems are sort of optimized almost in the exact opposite direction in terms of risk. And so I think that's where venture capital can butt heads or has butt heads with ag.
Ridiculous asking this question, but because you're all VCs, but does this mean that ag tech doesn't fit with venture capital?
Well, I'll chime in. I think there are limitations to the application of the standard venture model to agriculture for exactly the point that Sarah is mentioning and what Sarah and Matthew wrote about, which is, you know, if you think about what Facebook, their whole motto was move fast and break things. Well, what if you can move fast, but you don't break things, right? If you try to go disrupt the ag marketplace, but then you hit a brick wall because you realize that there's an entire system there to minimize risk, minimize disruption. And that's not just the farmer, that's everything behind it, all the way to crop insurance, right? And so you may think that if I can just get the farmer to adopt my tool, then it's game over, I'm gonna go disrupt the system. But you find that there's like multiple layers of that onion to peel back before you can actually make change to that system. And I think that's one of the big ahas that a lot of folks have had. So there are certainly opportunities, but I think it's a smaller subset than we might have thought about 7 years ago.
You know, a headline always has to be brief. And so the risk in saying something like how Silicon Valley killed ag tech is to imply that the whole model doesn't work. And the more nuanced view is there are key parts of it that are fundamental to the transformation that agriculture has to make. And so the sort of some of the key elements of the Silicon Valley model is driving really hard on the transformative potential of digital technology in particular, but let's just say technological transformation. Like, That is so true of agriculture. The, you know, when we've got satellites flying over the entire world a couple of times a day at 30 centimeter and below resolution with spectral depth and all that kind of stuff, like we will know things about the natural environment at very low cost, at very high resolution that we've never known before. And so that part of it is absolutely true. The transformative potential in technological innovation as applied to, you know, all kinds of physical industries is amazing, and it's inspiring. And I think it, what brings, you know, people like us together, I think the point we're trying to make is the bringing those things together along with this kind of pre-canned idea of this is how users take a delivery of technology. This is how users benefit from technology. This is how you monetize it. I think those are the bits, particularly in agriculture, where the template doesn't fit quite as well. And you have to kind of tease it apart. And that's where we're kind of getting to with that idea of the user different to the beneficiary, and really think in a more nuanced way about the business models that are required, because the tech part is fundamental. We have to have that transformative capacity. We've just got to think differently about how to make it stick.
And it's sort of exacerbated by how a lot of entrepreneurs end up coming into the industry, because if they haven't come from seeing how the supply chain and those incentives work, but they've come from the tech side or the farm side, it sort of at first seems obvious, like, oh, well, this widget will save us this percent on our water bill or on our diesel bill. And so, like, obviously everyone should do it, but you're sort of only looking at part of the picture and missing the broader drivers. And so it's not for lack of good intentions. Like, you go to these accelerator programs and they say, go talk to farmers, and you talk to farmers, but you're only looking at this small part of the system, and you've missed the unlock codes of what can drive adoption more broadly. Like, the first wave we saw that was, oh, let's sell direct to farmers. And then it was like, oh, let's go through the channel or talk to service providers, because they're the ones with the trusted advice. And so that's, you know, worked in some cases and is part of understanding the system. But you sort of zoom out again and see how much potential there is in the supply chain and how much that can drive adoption and really change the equation.
Sorry, I told Sarah I won't sing it, but I keep thinking, when I read your piece, I kept thinking about this Dave Mason song. I think it's called Disagree. And I won't sing it. The lyrics,
you can sing it.
Please do.
I'm going to spare you, but there ain't no good guy. There ain't no bad guy. There's just you and me, and we just disagree. And I look at venture capital, I look at agriculture, neither of them are particularly bad. They're just not agreeable to each other in many instances. And in defense of venture capital, the standard venture model is a 10-year-ish model, looking for, you know, alpha and, you know, multiples on money within a constrained time frame. If you've got that slower innovation cycle, you've got that risk avoidance mindset, that's where that incongruence actually occurs. And I don't think we have to lay blame. It's the limitations of both systems. And, you know, what Sarah and I were talking about is the need for alternative financing as well.
Yeah. I love it. It's actually the biologicals pod with that quote from Jarrett, which is logistics trumps technology. In those three words is so much understanding of the problem, right? Because the reality is that if I've got to plant that whole field today, it doesn't matter. Like, if it's going to rain next week or whatever, like, you can be offering me the best tech, the most sophisticated, whatever. If it's going to get in the way of getting done what needs to get done, you're just not even a starter. And I think that kind of thing is an example of what you're talking about. It's just like when those two worlds come together, and if you don't have that understanding, then whatever you're going to say next is just going to drop to the floor.
And there's a lot of money in that logistics, as someone who sees harvest every year. You're talking about the disconnect between the VC world and the ag world. Some of those big ag companies well-placed, or were they well-placed, particularly in the past, to step in there, like the Monsantos, who some of those companies that had those early venture arms?
I mean, it's interesting how in preparation for the article, I went back and read the original press release for the announcement of the climate acquisition, and what they talk about is weather insurance. And I had completely forgotten that was, you know, the business model way back then. And so I think, you know, yes and no, what that suite of products is now transformed into is barely recognizable from what was publicly viewable back then. Now, how much was in the can and how much of that was important to the acquisition, it's hard to know. I'm sure there are people who do know, But just at that point of even in the hands of the, you know, kind of larger incumbent, you know, multinationals, there was a lot that wasn't known. I think the risk part of that equation was, wow, if we stand to suffer the kind of disruption that's happened in other industries, we need to make some moves here. And the dollars are so big that big bets that were that had some risk, or at least risk of going to zero, were worth placing.
Sarah?
Oh, I was just going to say, like, we kind of talked about it in the article, that the what we've seen is those incumbents making acquisitions or kind of getting in the space for probably two key reasons. One is talent, like just acquiring a new skill set that they haven't had in-house, whether that's artificial intelligence or machine learning or access to Silicon Valley or programmers, you know, just a different kind of talent, and the ability to sort of protect and defend their existing revenue streams and business models. And it's interesting because that has made for acquisitions, and that's what the space wants, and that's how returns happen and the kind of cycle unfolds. Yet some of the opportunity that people see in agriculture is to kind of fully disrupt the system and have new incumbents or new transformations to the whole model. And so we, you know, that's been part of the challenge, and that's what we, you know, allude to being possible in the next wave in certain areas, but it's definitely not without its challenges. That's just what we've seen so far.
Yeah, and just to add to that, and, you know, Matthew and Sarah talk about it, but so for instance, you had climate purchase by Monsanto Bayer, you had granular purchase by DuPont and what Corteva, and what you've actually seen there is now they're giving that stuff away for free. So they did acquire it. They're pushing it through their channel. That's going to accelerate adoption because free is a pretty good price, but that's also a category killer for everybody else in the space. Yeah. So to boil it down, as we see ag, I kind of see two paths. It's not that critical to think about, but it's evolutionary or revolutionary. And most of the corporate VCs are probably looking at the evolutionary path. There are some exceptions, though. I think about what Tyson did in terms of making the investment in Beyond Meat, breaking out of the animal protein sector for that company. Look at Driscoll's partnering with Plenty on indoor berry production. There's some other examples out there where they're kind of sticking their toe in the revolutionary path, which will be interesting to see. Again, I'm not trying here to defend Silicon Valley or ag tech investing, but if you look at that evolutionary versus revolutionary path, you look at how much wind VC money has put into the revolutionary or alternative sales, whether that is alternative proteins, alternative production, the indoor greenhouse, vertical farming, that's benefited a lot. We'll see if it actually changes agriculture. We're still trying to figure out the evolutionary versus revolutionary path. They're going to coexist. But I think we have seen a benefit by having that talent and that money come into the space.
Yeah. Andreessen Horowitz, it's Alex Rample, has an interesting way of characterizing this, where he refers to it kind of as a race where the startup is trying to get distribution before the incumbent gets innovation. And I think that is part of what drives that desire to kind of place those bets. And yeah, Rob, you're absolutely right that, you know, some of those are very brave and kind of forward-thinking bets, like, as you say, betting on being disrupted. But I think the other side of that coin is that a lot of the time the Silicon Valley view is that it's largely about software, like innovation equals software. And I think that's one of the points that we're making, is that in ag, that's just not true.
It's not getting any less true. Like, when we think, we've been doing a bunch of small group discussions over the past couple of weeks thinking about sustainability, and almost every, if not every, sustainability problem, it's yes, we need data, yes, we need interoperability, but then we need to go physically do something in the world or change something. We need to, like, process the waste, we need to make the biological, we need to turn on the pump. And so this idea that the software alone can be the solution, yeah, maybe great economics, but if it doesn't actually solve the problem, then what are we really doing? And so that's bringing in a whole new layer of, I think Silicon Valley's evolving in this direction too, of needing to look at biology, needing to look at hardware, needing to look at deep tech, whatever you want to call it, to solve some of these climate problems especially. But in agriculture, that's absolutely true. And it is a whole new skill set and way of thinking about these investments.
Is there an example anyone could give of and I know people don't want to throw a company under the bus, but in the past of an early ag tech, or maybe not even early ag tech, but, you know, startup that just made some of these mistakes, or even in an epic fail? If you've got a story like that, what's the one that it's your 101 lesson on what not to do?
I'll share a war story. We had a company that shall remain nameless, and we seeded the deal, and we had a very well-established Silicon Valley investor who came in and led a substantial Series A. And we were high-fiving each other because we thought our work was done, because it was now in the hands of a much bigger fund with adult supervision. And the reality was the company was, it had a little bit of a delay, maybe one season, but the reality was it was doing fine as an ag tech company. We had over 90% renewal of the product. We had good channels stepping in, but for this Silicon Valley investor, that growth wasn't fast enough. And so they kept trying to see what they could do to increase the numbers to go up and to the right, taking on new products, bigger markets, all causing the CEO to have to do double backflips that the company just wasn't built for. And so we were a bit frustrated because we could see that this was a good ag tech company and we're headed to the right, on the right path for a good acquisition, but it wasn't happening fast enough for that Silicon Valley investor. And it didn't end well. And I'll stop there. I need to go find a Kleenex now.
We've seen it a few times with companies that we, you know, that come to us for in the kind of raise process. And they say, you know, they're almost apologetic about their revenue numbers. And they're sort of like, look, we really wanted to get the product right. And we have these partnerships and we're really working on them. But we know that, like, you know, you and all the other VCs want us to have sold this product, you know, way more times. And it's interesting because they come to us as an ag tech investor and we're able to say, well, no, it probably doesn't make sense to have a bunch of hardware in a bunch of different places, because like, how do you, you know, deploying a fix to all of those and it's going to break. And like, you know, you don't need that really early mass adoption because you're going about this a different way. And that actually is going to be way worse for you. And they've just been told by so many VCs to get those sales up at the expense of everything else. And then they end up spending tons of money solving problems completely unscalably because they got really bad advice or advice that wasn't tailored to their model, especially if they have a hardware component.
Hey, if I can, I want to give a shout out to Agthentic because Sarah, as you have probably heard me, I cite your report that talked about the survey of incubators, accelerators, and venture support, and the fact that we have over 150 globally for ag tech. And I think part of the problem is that you might see a sexy IoT company and some accelerator incubators like, this one's going to be different, or they don't even know about the other 32 that exist. And so they get behind that one and they get them into that cycle. So you have a lot of people that are running incubators and accelerators who are feeding this to the VCs, feeding this to the big companies. And there's a knock-on effect where you get the innovation fatigue. You get the companies that are just, you know, stuck out in the valley of death. And I think that's yet another symptom from that Silicon Valley model that has been a bit problematic, to be polite.
And it's meant that people are frustrated, exactly as you said. I mean, you go talk to some of these corporates who've been pitched by 70 of those 150 accelerators to sponsor their programs. And they're like, but you're not bringing me anything new or interested or connected to my model at all. And so, yeah, I get that, you know, some nice PR or, you know, I might meet some smart people, but like, you know, I'm not getting the results I need. And that's been tough because there is good stuff out there. And you know, maybe that model has been challenging in kind of serving it up on a platter in the way that you maybe it wanted to.
Yeah. I was actually talking to a farming corporation the other day who have a system on how to say no to ag tech. Like that's what they call it. And they use ag tech on their farm and they like it, but they have a system for how to say no. So that's really interesting. I wanted to move on to the solution. You all wouldn't be here in this industry if you didn't think there was a solution. Ag tech 2.0, what are we doing differently? What's the game changer? Rob, we can start with you.
Oh, thanks for the easy one. I think it's interesting. So again, I cited before the limitations of the venture capital model for ag tech. And I think that there's been a realization even by some of the people that are writing really big checks. I'll tell you the parachute that everybody's grabbing right now is the SPAC exit model or growth financing, depending on how you want to look at it. It's not quite clear how long that SPAC exit door is going to be open or not. But I think, you know, fundamentally, we've just got to come up with different models other than the standard 10-year venture capital fund that meet the needs. There are a lot of really good companies in ag tech. They just may not meet the metrics of a standard VC fund. And so there's a lot of innovation and a lot of room for growth. It's just, we need to find ways to fund those companies.
Matt, Sarah?
Well, I mean, I think we touched on, it's important for us to be positive and come forward with solutions. This isn't about rock throwing it at stuff that hasn't worked, because otherwise we wouldn't know what is more likely to work. But I think, you know, what's really exciting about what we're seeing now is this understanding of the importance of looking upstream and downstream from where you are in the supply chain, and really understanding how value kind of accretes, and therefore who are the, you know, we create that kind of idea of separating out the user from the beneficiary, right? And so by understanding the difference, actually maybe it gets back to the point about the kind of innovation versus the business model, right? The innovation probably is targeted more at the user, but the business model has to be targeted at the beneficiary, because otherwise it doesn't have any prospect of self-sufficiency. I think what we are looking for as an investor is that level of understanding and insight in putting as much thought into solving the business model as whatever innovation kind of creates the opportunity in the first place.
This doesn't go to necessarily Silicon Valley business models, but one of the other things that's changing, and has definitely changed the conversations with corporates investing in this space and thinking about outsourced R&D, is the climate pressures they're facing and the sustainability kind of related commitment pressures that they're facing. The world where kind of corporate sustainable social responsibility sits in a room and has really no budget but writes some nice reports is increasingly not the world we live in. It's integrated with strategy. It's thinking about sourcing. It's thinking about business models. It's thinking about venture. And so the kind of muscle that's going into enabling technologies that are helping with the transition to lower chemical intensity or combined biological and synthetic products or automation or alternative proteins, it's just so much more of a industry knowledge that hasn't maybe come to bear because it's been left to Silicon Valley, is showing up to this party and requiring solutions and getting involved in creating them.
And I think if we're talking about solutions, then, you know, maybe we could sort of separate out what we had more focused on was what startups need to do, but actually Rob's call out there is also what does venture need to do, right? Think about the model differently, structure yourself differently, look at evergreen kind of structures, things that are more aligned to the period of time it's probably going to take these companies to really make their business model stick. And I think that those are two separate, but both really important things to point out.
So I won't take off my shirt, but I've got war wounds from my mobile days where basically I invested in a company that did Facebook Live before Facebook really existed, and it was cool. It was fantastic. But trying to do audio video on a Nokia N95 to port to the Symbian operating system for $70,000 to get your billing done by AT&T and an alphanumeric keyboard was a pain, right? Then this company, Apple, comes out with this iPhone, and it's not really like it can't withstand a Finnish winter. It doesn't have a 4-day battery life, but it's really good for the internet. And it comes with an ecosystem that you can get your app approved easily and quickly. You can get payments. You can leverage the GPS on the phone really easily. All of that stuff made it super easy. And my point is two things. One, we need those ecosystems, right? Those platforms in agriculture, whether that's a John Deere Ops Center. I'm really excited to see actually what TELUS and Rabobank do with Conservice, because now you might actually have a way to get into farm management information systems. And if we can get those kind of things, that might be the kind of thing that can change agriculture and make those digital solutions better. As Matt and Sarah know, I am all about the need for interoperable data in agriculture. And if we actually do want the food companies to pay farmers, they've got to be able to get that data, that tracking and transparency, whether that's paying for carbon credits. We got to have that data flow along the value chain. And I think that's something that we need to recognize. I'll just finish with my colleague, Shauna Day, talks about the staircase of food and ag tech adoption, where we need to crawl before we walk, before we run. And before we can just throw robots out in the field, we need to digitize information. We need to measure, manage, optimize, and then we can automate. And it's the same thing here. If you look, the biggest barrier that we have to digitizing ag right now is the farmer's notebook, because they're all walking around with a little pocketbook. No one's getting the benefit of all the thoughts and the data that is in that little book. And so we need to get that digitized. So like, that's the basic crawling that we still need to do in agriculture before we can unleash all the other things that we're talking about.
Yeah, great, great example. Actually, shout out to Ollie Madjed and the group doing the thing called Collabriculture, which is a quite targeted, but it's a open developed vine row model. So to your point, you know, if you want yield estimation and automated pruning and kind of robotic weeding, all those kind of things to cooperate across a range of different vendors, you know, you have to be able to describe the vine rows and, you know, like the entire structure of the vineyard. And actually probably the Western Growers Association with the work they're doing is another good example, Rob, of what you were talking about, which is industry has got together and said, look, you know, we're sick of you guys dropping robots on our farm and then hitting the wall at high speed. And then, you know, now what do we do? And so they're kind of leaning in and saying, we're gonna create this infrastructure, and then you can build your systems around the ecosystem that we've created as an industry.
Kirsten, if we can jump in with a quick story. I was talking to a Southern US cotton farmer who was using an Australian ag tech tool, and she had furrowed her field. And so she was looking to capture that information in this tool, say I furrowed field number 45. Well, she couldn't find that activity in this because the Aussies call furrowing a light tickle of a field. And so we don't even have the Australian and English, American yeah. English are using different terms. So how do you expect a computer to be able to use that? And so how can we standardize on one of those two terms? I do like light tickle, but it usually means something else to me.
I like that.
That's great. And I really enjoyed your story about the farmer using the handbooks. I can attest on our farm, I'm very much trying to incorporate AgriWeb into the business and using software, and my husband won't let go of his clipboard. And so then there's this process where he just hands me the clipboard and then I have to do data entry, and it sort of defeats the purpose because of the time. It's just not worth anyone's time doing that. And I guess that whole point goes to changing users' behavior and how do you do that. And the other one I think we haven't touched on is the supply chain. There seems to be focus more on the beneficiaries in the supply chain. Sarah, would you be able to touch on that?
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit in terms of the kind of threat that many of the food corporations, processing companies, input companies are facing, and for them to be able to make claims about the scope 2, scope 3 emissions that they need to offset. They need to know what's going on farm, which also helps them manage risk in the supply chains and think about procurement decisions and quality and all the information they need, but they just don't have it right now. And so when you think about those companies and the pressures they're under as the incentive to get those programs and those technologies in the hands of the farmers, then it really changes the equation because they have that really strong incentive. And so whether it's they subsidize the cost or they create programs or they create incentives around premiums or market access or tiered programs, whatever it is, to help cover that kind of delta between what the benefits are that the farmer is getting and the actual benefit that's being realized. That doesn't work without data interoperability. So we don't want a bunch of different systems that still can't talk to each other. We'll still have a bunch of problems. But when we look to the pressures in the supply chain, they often are the ones upstream or downstream of the farmers that have a much stronger incentive and can help solve some of this adoption conundrum.
Yeah, I mean, when the meat processor in Warrnambool is offering, you know, 3% price premium on the grid prices for lamb, so long as you can provide the data, then you've got a reason to enter the data, right? Right now, I wouldn't say it's a software problem. It's an incentive problem. Like it's, you know, there'll be degrees to which one piece of software is easier to use than another, but that's market, right? Like the market will solve that problem. The real problem is there's no really good reason to take the time to enter the data into the software.
I wanted to end with asking everyone a kind of big picture question, because you know, you're here talking as investors, talking as people who work with startups. So obviously there are reasons why you want to see agriculture digitized, why you want it to become digitally native. But why is it important overall? Why should farmers care? Why should farmers who are quite happy doing what they're doing change what they're doing? Why does the food system need to become digitized?
So I think there's really two big drivers here. One is the absolute threat that we face from climate change and just the ability to do what we have done in the past. It's increasingly obvious that that just won't work anymore. I mean, yields are plateauing. We've got resistance problems. We're running out of topsoil. We're running out of water. Like, there's all kinds of reasons why the kind of status quo isn't going to work. And so we need new solutions. And we've seen that in Australia. And that's why the Australian farmers have been innovative. And we've developed a lot of technology down under. The other one would be, there are, on an even larger scale, just existential climate threats that we face. And agriculture is in this kind of pivotal moment of, is it going to be the villain or is it going to be part of the solution? And they, why should farmers care? Well, absolutely, to be part of the solution, whether that's through, you know, nature-based solutions, through how land is managed, through how food is grown and how they participate in the supply chain. There's an absolute opportunity to be part of the hero of this story instead of part of the villain of this story. And if it doesn't change, I think there's a world where we say, well, let's just grow this stuff in a lab. Let's corporatize how land is owned. You know, there's a future that it doesn't look very good for, I think, a kind of rural agrarian picture and diversified land management and absolute opportunities to live and manage farmland. And so there's a both an imperative and an opportunity that I see.
I think from my perspective, the more I dig into the space, the more intrigued I get. And I think there are a number of, I call them the wows, that just really stunned me. One, just stepping into the space, I thought we had, coming from the outside, I thought we had a much deeper understanding of soil than we actually did. Soil keeps civilization alive. Two, I recognize now that we have a medical industry that does not understand food as thy medicine. The average doctor in the US only gets 12 hours of nutritional training. Nurses get even less. Three, we don't really understand, let's call it nutrition, personalized nutrition. We were all to eat a Twinkie. What the impact would be on our bodies, we don't really understand that all too well. Fourth, we don't really understand how to get consumers not to eat the cheapest and most convenient foods. And then the last one, which is something that Matt and Sarah talked about, is I'm amazed at how little digital connection there is between the farm and the fork. And so I look at those five big challenges as like, we got to figure these things out. And that's what I think really keeps me going in this space.
Great. Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think excited by all these opportunities. Our natural environment is now visible in a way that it's never been before. And increasingly, most enlightened consumers, and yeah, we want that number to be bigger, are increasingly interested in the relationship between what they're eating and the natural environment. And overwhelmingly, the food that we create comes from the natural environment. And historically, farmers have been very motivated to take care of the natural environment, but mostly because it sustained their family business, right? Not because they were worried about or wanting to engage with the people who could clearly see what they're doing. I worry that we're still partly in this posture of it's my farm, I can do what I want, versus, you know, everybody actually can see what you're doing. And so leaning into that and saying, come take a look, right? We're proud of being the custodians of the land. We're proud of being the people who grow the food that you all eat. And we want to engage in this conversation, but it's got to be a two-way conversation, right? And so I think that's the second part, which is the hugely exciting, again, potential that's being created by technology to see that the benefits of being a visibly good custodian of land don't just mean there's an asset there that you can pass on to your family, but that you get recognized for those dual roles of being the people who create the food and being the people who at the same time care for and enhance the natural environment, especially as we're moving into a version of the planet that's going to be very different from the version that the current generation's parents kind of grew up on.
And that's it for our bonus episode of Ag Tech So What. Thank you for listening. And if you like what you hear, please tell a friend. And if you haven't read it already, you can find a link to Sarah and Matt's article, How Silicon Valley Set Ag Tech Back a Decade, on our website, agtechsowhat.com, as well as links to other resources mentioned in this episode. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Sarah will be back next week with another episode. We'll catch you then.